everyone. Jeb Sharp here with How We Got Here, the history podcast from PRI's The World, a public radio program about all things global. It's co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. As regular listeners know, sometimes we tackle one topic, other times we tackle several. Sometimes we do original interviews, other times we just mine the big show for historical gems. That's the case this week. It's been an especially rich period for casting back into the past. Let's start with the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War on April 12th.
Americans mark the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War today. It was on April 12th, 1861, that the Confederate bombardment of Union-held Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor began. The Civil War ended 4 years and 600,000 deaths later. As it happens, the turmoil of 1861 was not confined to America. The world then was not a peaceful one, according to Brian DeLay. He teaches history at the University of California, Berkeley. Brian, give us a bit of the global context here. What was happening elsewhere while the Civil War was raging here?
Well, of the many stories that were unfolding at the same time of the Civil War around the world, there's really two that I think are most important to talk about in connection with the Civil War. The first happened in Mexico. Many Americans don't realize that Mexico had its own Civil War about the same time as ours. After independence in 1821, Mexico encountered decades of serial problems, fiscal problems, internal crises. This was only compounded during the U.S.-Mexican War in 1848, when the United States took half of Mexico's national territory. And by the late 1850s, there were fierce battles raging in Mexico over the nature of government. Conservatives in Mexico were able to prevail upon authorities in France to help install a European prince as monarch in Mexico in 1864.
Wow.
And it actually resulted in a three-year civil war in Mexico, where the United States supplied arms and support as it was able, given its distractions, to liberal forces in the country, which eventually prevail and take the capital, execute Maximilian, and inaugurate a period of stability and prosperity in Mexico.
That was the first big story. What was the second one in your mind that's important?
Well, the second one has to do with international cotton markets. And on the eve of the American Civil War, the United States South supplied the vast majority of the core ingredient to the industrial economies of the world, and that was cotton. The United States South supplied perhaps 77% of the cotton consumed by Great Britain's textile mills and something on the order of 90% of the cotton consumed by mills in France and Russia. And when what historian Sven Becker calls the cotton famine happened as a consequence of the American Civil War, these governments had to scramble to find new sources of cotton to continue to fuel their industrialization. And so what we see are really profound and massive transformations, for example, in India, where Britain sort of naturally turns to immediately once it becomes clear that cotton is not going to be available from the United States South any longer. And in just 2 years, India goes from supplying really trivial amounts of cotton to about 70%. This is true for France as well. So India becomes almost overnight a major, major producer of cotton for the world economy. There's a similar story that happens in Egypt's Nile Delta and on the northeast coast of Brazil. And these really rapid, phenomenally rapid transformations have profound implications not only for the global cotton economy, but for the lives of workers around the world.
Brian DeLay teaches history at UCal Berkeley. Thanks very much, Brian.
My pleasure.
And now we move from 1861 to 1896.
The main island of Japan was struck by a great earthquake wave, a tsunami, which was more destructive of life and property than any earthquake convulsion of this century.
This doesn't describe the earthquake and tsunami that just struck northeastern Japan. Nope, it's an excerpt from an article written for National Geographic more than 100 years ago. It's about the Meiji Sanriku tsunami that swept across Japan's northeast coast on June 15, 1896. The article is written by an American writer and photographer, Eliza Sidmore. Sidmore grew up in Washington, D.C., with a yearning for travel. She began reporting all over the world, especially in Asia and Japan. In 1896, she was visiting her brother George, who was working for the American consulate in Yokohama. After the tsunami hit, Eliza went to the scene. She spoke with survivors and took photos of the devastation. Renee Brayton manages the archives, rare books, and collections for National Geographic Society in Washington.
Eliza is writing through eyewitness accounts of fishermen, their families, people in these very small fishing villages. What she's been told, it's a very high wall of water, much devastation and destruction. Almost 27,000 people have lost their lives. And one of the ways that they know that is through the very, very detailed and careful census studies done in Japan. It's very unadorned. It feels modern when you read it. It's extremely evocative.
So this is what Eliza wrote about what the survivors told her about the tsunami.
One loyal schoolmaster carried the emperor's portrait to a place of safety before seeking out his own family. A half-demented soldier, retired since the late war and continually brooding on a possible attack by the enemy, became convinced that the first cannonading sound was from a hostile fleet, and seizing his sword, ran down to the beach to meet the foe. In a moment, the waters disappeared, leaving a black, empty level where the populous village had been a few minutes before. The only survivors of another village were eight men who had been playing the game of Go in a hillside temple. From two large villages on one bay, only 30 young men survived, hardy, muscular young fishermen and powerful swimmers. Yet in other places, the strongest perished, and the aged and infirm, cripples, and tiny children were miraculously preserved.
Renee, do you know how she conducted her reporting? Because it was so difficult, obviously even more so than it is right now, to get around in Japan following that tsunami. How did she come across so many stories of so many survivors?
We don't know that. We do know she knew a lot of influential people through her brother's work at the consulate, and I imagine that she was able to travel to places that would have been harder for other people to get to.
And among the people she writes about is the Reverend Rothsay Miller. This is an American missionary who made, as she says, the usual 3 days trip over the mountains in less than a day and a half on his American bicycle. How long after the tsunami in June did the word get out? When did National Geographic run the story?
The story appears in September of 1896.
And was that the first word of it? Is that how the rest of the world found out?
I don't think so. I think there were probably some other newspaper accounts, but she quickly filed this story for the Geographic.
We should say, Renee, that there was so much admiration on the part of the Japanese government for Eliza Sidmore, this writer, that they asked for her ashes to be buried in Japan. They were, eventually. Where is she now laid to rest?
Eliza's ashes are in the Yokohama Foreigners Cemetery. She died in 1928 in Geneva. She requested that her body be cremated and that just disposed of properly is all we know about that. And the Japanese asked for her ashes. The family thought that that's what she would want. And they were a Japanese minister who was in Switzerland at the time conveyed the ashes back to Japan.
I wonder, as we close out, Renee, if you could make the link for us between Eliza Sidmore, this writer from the 1800s, and the cherry blossoms that we see even today in Washington, D.C.
Yes, Eliza fell in love with the cherry blossoms when she lived in Japan and hoped for something like that to come to Washington, where we had a lot of barren land near the Potomac River. And it took her over 20 years to convince people in the government that this was a good idea. And in 1912, when Mrs. Taft was First Lady, she believed in Eliza's idea, and together they made the trees happen. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation now because they're almost at peak.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., home of the cherry blossoms, Renee Braden, archivist for the National Geographic Society in Washington. National Geographic republished the article written by author Eliza Sidmore on the 1896 tsunami in Japan. We're going to have it on our website, theworld.org. Thank you, Renee.
Thank you.
I'll make sure that link is also posted on the How We Got Here page at theworld.org/history. And that, of course, was the big show's Lisa Mullins there interviewing Renee Braden about Eliza Sidmore. We're going to move on to a very different subject now, which is harrowing in its own way. It's a story about the abuses of empire, and specifically about alleged British atrocities in Kenya during the counterinsurgency campaign against Mau Mau rebels there during the 1950s. Here's the world's Marco Werman.
Distant memories of beatings and torture spilled into a London courtroom today. Four elderly Kenyans are suing the British government. They claim they were abused at the hands of British authorities during the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya in the 1950s. The four are among a group of thousands who were detained. The group also included Barack Obama's grandfather. The world's Laura Lynch reports from London. A note here, the story includes descriptions of violence that some may find disturbing.
It was a time of rebellion against colonial rule. The British and their supporters were the targets.
In Nairobi, capital of Kenya, Europeans and Africans still walk the streets in fear of the dreaded Mau Mau.
The Mau Mau killed thousands, prompting Britain to declare a state of emergency in 1952. More than 100,000 Kenyans were hauled into detention camps suspected of being rebels. Wambuga wa Naingi was held at one of those camps in 1959.
The people in charge of the detention camp ordered that we start digging. And when we were digging, they started beating us. They were beating us with huge sticks, and I lost consciousness. When I came to, I saw that all my colleagues, the 11 of them, were dead.
Naingi was held for 9 years without charge. He claims he witnessed British officers take part in beatings and torture.
One morning, there came a battalion of white officers together with black people, and they began to take people out to behind where the people had been locked up, and they started clobbering them to death. A number of people were castrated. Others had their testicles smashed with a club. On the spot, 14 people died.
Naingi is one of four Kenyans, all in their 70s and 80s, who have traveled to London to press their case. Their lawyer, Martin Day, says they deserve justice.
This is a case not about reopening the old wounds, but it's about individuals who are alive today and who have suffered the most terrible, terrible things at the hands of the British. Now is a time for us to try and reach some sort of resolution to that. We hope the court will today, over the next few days, give us a positive answer.
In court today, a lawyer for the British government admitted torture and killings took place, but he argued that since there was no explicit law authorizing the violence, the government isn't responsible. Newly released documents may tell a different story. David Anderson is a professor of African politics at Oxford University. He's examined many of the files.
Senior members of the Colonial Office in London did know what was happening. Senior legal officials in London did, to some extent, sanction the use of coercive force. And also, at cabinet level, the Secretary of State for the Colonies certainly knew of the excesses that were taking place.
Most of those who died during the uprising were black Kenyans. They were killed by Mau Mau rebels when they refused to join the fight.
No one's apologised to them from the Mau Mau. None of the Mau Mau are talking about giving them compensation. Why isn't someone saying to these Mau Mau, you want an apology from the British government? OK, fine. But why don't you, for a change, apologise to the 10,000 of your own tribe, the Kikuyu, that you slaughtered?
Tim Simmons worked for the Kenyan Police Reserve in the 1950s and saw the violence up close. Simmons agrees those who were abused in the camps should be compensated, but he says it was right to crush the insurgents.
They really got what they deserved. I'm really quite tough on this. If I had a chance again in the same situation, them killing people, would I go out and kill them again as I did? Yes, sir, I would.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu is urging the British government to settle with the victims.
This is not a legal issue. It is a moral issue. And even if they were to win the legal battle, they would leave an enormous moral blot on their record.
It's a sentiment echoed by Oxford professor David Anderson.
At a time like this, when members of our Foreign Office and ministers stand up talking about potential war crimes prosecutions in Libya, they should also look to their own backyard and to things that went on under the British flag.
It may not be that simple for the government. If it loses, the case could pave the way for thousands of others who claim they also suffered under colonial rule in Kenya and other nations. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in London.
Laura's story aired on April 7th. A week later, we followed up on her report with an interview with historian Carolyn Elkins. She's a professor at Harvard, and she's done extensive research on exactly this topic.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Counterinsurgency is not easy. The U.S. knows something about that, especially now after years of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. History shows that even successful counterinsurgency campaigns often leave a troubled legacy. One example is the British campaign against the Mau Mau movement in Kenya in the 1950s. The Kikuyu and other ethnic groups in central Kenya rebelled against colonial rule and demanded access to land held by white settlers. The British cracked down hard. Last week, we reported how victims of that repression are suing in London for compensation. Their plight was highlighted in the 2005 Pulitzer Prize-winning Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, by Caroline Elkins. She's a professor of African history at Harvard. Elkins is just back from testifying in the case and joins us in the studio. Professor Elkins, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, when you wrote your book, there wasn't much in ways of official documentation, but that's just changed in a dramatic way. Tell us what happened.
Yes, you know, it's been extraordinary. At the time of decolonization, a great number of the files were destroyed, and many were withheld by the British government. And for years, we've been asking for these files, those that have been withheld. And literally in the 11th and a half hour of the court case, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office disclosed these files, 300 boxes in total, about 17,000 files.
And what do these files say? What are in these documents?
It's extremely important insofar as they tell us in part what we've already known. In other words, there was a great deal of work that I undertook in my research to piece this story back together again with the existing files. And I also did hundreds of interviews with survivors of the detention camps and emergency villages that the British had set up, a complete system of brutality and torture in Kenya. And since then, they have the response from British officials has been, Elkins is wrong. And I think what these documents are telling us is not only was I right in this, but the claimants that are coming forward right now have plenty of evidence, including their own, that needs to be taken seriously.
Did you meet with the four Kenyan plaintiffs in the lawsuit? I mean, what do they want? What is their kind of goal here?
Yes, I have met with them, and in fact was just with them in London. And I think their goals are not dissimilar to those goals of individuals who I interviewed in the late 1990s. And that was, one, they want people to know what happened to them. In other words, this story was silenced for many, many years. And secondly, they're very, very interested and I think deserving of an apology.
How bad was the British campaign against the Mau Mau uprising? How bad did it get?
It was extraordinary in terms of the level of torture and brutality. And I think one of the things that was also extraordinary was the degree to which the British went to cover this up. And it's only based upon my own research, as well as the recent revelations coming out of the British government in terms of newly disclosed documents, that we have a sense of the kind of torture and systematized violence that was condoned at the very highest levels of British governments in order to reclaim Kenya for the sake of civilization.
Now, one of the central issues of abuse concerns the processing of the Kenyan detainees, mostly Kikuyu detainees. The British colonial authorities basically detained the entire adult male population of the disaffected ethnic groups, but slowly released them after processing through what was called the pipeline. Now, this is from a document that you had seen. This came out before this current stock of documents was released. I'd like to read just one passage that talks about how the British were very firm in making sure the detainees wore the camp uniform. Gavigan, he's the British officer who was in charge of these camps. Gavigan explained, however, that there had in past intakes been more persistent resistors who had to be forcibly changed into the camp clothing, that some of them had started the Mau Mau moan, a familiar cry which was promptly taken up by the rest of the camp, representing a concerted and symbolic defiance of the camp authorities, that in such cases it was essential to prevent the infection of this moan spreading through the camp, and that accordingly a resistor who started it was promptly put on the ground, a foot placed on his throat, and mud stuffed in his mouth, and that a man whose resistance could not be broken down was in the last resort knocked unconscious. Now, the evidence grows worse than that, much worse, as you know, Caroline. And even more gruesome, perhaps, is the appendix in which the British written rules are enumerated that gave the British officials the right to do these things. Tell us how close the British government is to acknowledging this carefully engineered campaign against the Mau Mau.
It's an important question because, you know, for years subsequent to the publication of my book, there was denial that there was any kind of systematic torture. There were one-offs, bad apples, if you will, in the British colonial administration. And there has been very much a turnaround in this insofar as there is not much contestation in terms of fact any longer. The contestation is over who is responsible. And at this juncture, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is suggesting through a legal maneuver that the British government is actually no longer liable for these crimes that were committed.
How do they make that law? logic turnaround?
Well, the logic turnaround is in this, in terms of responsibility. What they are suggesting is that all legal liability and responsibility pass to the Kenyan government at the time of independence.
Even though these crimes, as they are, took place during the 1950s? I mean, wasn't that prior to independence?
Was prior to independence and quite extraordinary. But nonetheless, what they are suggesting is that things went with the right of state, with the right of passage in terms of the independence transition. And again, it's extraordinary. When one thinks about it, even if they get away with this in terms of legal maneuver, in the court of public opinion, one has to imagine that people look at this and suggest not only are they no longer contesting fact, but they're also contesting the fact that they have any kind of responsibility.
I mean, the catalog of abuses is horrific, but one point has to be made, and that is this was a comparatively successful counterinsurgency campaign. The detainees pipeline did flip a critical mass of former Mau Mau guerrillas. Can you also make that argument, Caroline Elkins?
Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, I wouldn't. Listen, it depends on how you define success. At what cost did they have success? And in this instance, it was with known and systematized brutality and torture against tens of thousands of people, number one. Now, yes, did it get Britain out of the empire? Did it get them out of Kenya? Absolutely. But one has to ask about the long-term consequences of this. Not only do we see people irreparably damaged, 70 and 80 years old, living in the central province of Kenya, but we see states like post-independent Kenya and other places in the empire where similar kinds of counterinsurgency operations were invoked. We see these places as states where they continue to have authoritarian issues, where they continue to deploy the similar kinds of laws on the books that the British used to torture their own people. One has to ask about the question of colonial legacy and its relationship to the ways in which Britain leveled these counterinsurgency operations.
What is the lesson, do you think, for Americans who may in future find themselves fighting counterinsurgency campaigns?
I think this is a very important cautionary tale for all of us. Britain deployed extraordinary tactics, torture and brutality, and went to incredible lengths to cover it up. We also know that in the 1950s, the British passed these same tactics directly to the Americans with a special envoy, Sir Robert Thompson, to the American administration. We deployed them in Vietnam and is now serving as the blueprint for our actions in the war against terror. I think we need to take a long, hard look at what's going on and to look at what happened in the past in places like Kenya and to understand the ways in which it's informing our actions today.
Caroline Elkins, author of Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. Thanks very much for coming in. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
I'll post various links to the Kenya story at theworld.org/history, including some video from that interview with Marco and Caroline Elkins. Now, don't go away. There are two more stories on the History Pod this week. We're now moving on to the Cold War in the 1960s. April 12th marked the 50th anniversary of the first human being in space, the Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin. He completed one orbit of the Earth and returned a hero. The Big Show's Clark Boyd tells us about his legacy.
Yuri Gagarin's jaunt into space captured the world's imagination in 1961. Here's how the BBC reported the story.
Here is the news. All Moscow is waiting to give a hero's welcome to the world's first spaceman, Major Gagarin of the Soviet Air Force. Here's a Moscow recording of his voice as he went through space.
For the Soviets, it was a time of celebration. Sergei Khrushchev is son of then-Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev.
For him, it was one more proof that we are doing right, and of course that we show outside world that we can achieve all the things.
For the Soviets, Gagarin was PR gold. The cosmonaut wasn't just honored in the Soviet Union. After his historic journey into space, he went on a kind of world tour. This BBC newsreel captures his welcome in Manchester, England.
The Amalgamated Union of Foundry Workers made him number one honorary member and gave him a gold medal.
But, says Sergei Khrushchev, not everyone was happy.
In any race, if you are first, you're just celebrating. If you are second, then you are just have very sad days.
We are behind, but we are working hard, and we are going to increase our effort.
For President Kennedy and many in the U.S. at the time, Gagarin's flight was the latest in an alarming string of Soviet accomplishments. Kathleen Lewis is a curator at the National Air and Space Museum.
The Soviet Union had launched the first artificial satellite. They had launched the first animal into space, like the dog. They were the first country to actually target the moon and have an impact on the moon. And now here they're launching the first human into space.
By the end of the decade, the U.S. Apollo program would put the first humans on the moon. Gagarin would not live to see that. He died in 1968 during a training accident. These days, with the Cold War far behind, NASA astronaut Michael Foll pays tribute to Gagarin.
The idea of working together in space at that time was inconceivable. Today, we can all be extraordinarily proud of the people that have come before us in transitioning from this very, very opponent-based attempt to conquer space to one of partnership.
One place that's certainly true is aboard the International Space Station. With the space shuttle nearing retirement, Russia's Soyuz rockets are the only way to get there and back. Last night, American astronaut Katherine Coleman, who is on board the space station, teamed up with Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson for a flute duet in Gagarin's honor. For the World, this is Clark Boyd.
I'll post a link to video of that space duet at theworld.org/history, and also a link to Clark's tech podcast, which is not to be missed. And finally, on today's How We Got Here, last week was also the 50th anniversary of the ill-fated Bay of Pigs invasion. Here's Marco again.
The anniversary is cause for celebration in Cuba. The island's communist regime likes to recall its victory over the 1,300 exiles who landed on beaches in southern Cuba back in 1961. Then-President John F. Kennedy was under pressure to oust Fidel Castro from power, but Kennedy assured Americans just days before the Bay of Pigs that U.S. troops would not invade Cuba.
There will not be, under any conditions, be an intervention in Cuba by United States Armed Forces, and this government will do everything it possibly can to make sure that there are no Americans involved in any actions inside Cuba.
Kennedy had inherited a different plan hatched under President Eisenhower's administration. The plan called for CIA-trained exiles to slip onto the island and start a rebellion. They tried to do so in mid-April 1961. Almost immediately, they came under heavy fire. They were strafed by Cuban planes. Two of their supply ships were sunk. Cuban-born Alfredo Duran was among the exiles, whose small boats approached the Bay of Pigs under cover of darkness.
When we first saw the coast of Cuba, we started singing the Cuban national anthem, and we were ready to go and do our duty. It was a very, very emotional place. Of course, from the very beginning, things started going wrong, but at the very first night, the viewing of the Cuban coast was probably one of the most emotional moments I've had in my life.
Wow. So, I mean, given the context, you were, shall we say, up for the fight. When did you realize, though, that the operation would fail?
Well, we realized that there was something completely wrong with the plan when we were landed into what was supposed to be a sandy beach, and it was full of rocks, and we landed in what basically were outboard boats, basically used for sport fishing, and many of them were ramming against the rocks and sinking. So we were in the middle of the bay with all our gear, and we had to swim for our lives. And then the other thing that completely destroyed us was the basic thing that we were supposed to not be concerned with the Cuban Air Force. And obviously, since very early in the morning, the Cuban Air Force started bombarding us and strafing us with machine guns. So we obviously knew that the plan was not working. We were very much concerned. On the third day, when we ran out of ammunition, we had an ammunition drop, and there were four bullets for rifles that we did not carry with us, which were Springfield rifles that they dropped the ammunition, and we were carrying M1 rifles. So basically, the plan was a flop from the very beginning.
You and some of your surviving comrades went days without fresh water. You trekked through the brush and tried to survive on crabs, and you were captured by Castro's forces and went to prison. How is it that you were finally released?
Well, we were in the middle of the swamp, but there was a part of that swamp that there was no water. As a matter of fact, when I was captured, I told the militiaman who captured me, give me some water and then shoot me, because we thought that we were all going to be killed anyway. But finally, we were released because the Cuban government declared us prisoners of war and declared us mercenaries and made the United States government responsible for us and said, you can release them in payment of a ransom. There were three prices, one for $100,000 for their leaders, $50,000 for what they consider middle and upper class, and $25,000 for what they consider lumping or lower classes of Cubans that were there. So Bobby Kennedy created a nonprofit tax-free organization, which a lot of U.S. companies made tax-free contributions, and that got up to $62 million, which was the total price, and that was paid in food, medicine, and tractors.
Years after the fighting at the Bay of Pigs, you settled in the U.S. and became a lawyer. You were active politically and became president of the Bay of Pigs Veterans Association, but ultimately you were expelled from that group. Why were you kicked out, Mr. Duran? What sort of transformation were you going through at the time?
Well, I took the position that we had to do away with the embargo and let the Cubans try to deal with our own problem and start a dialogue and start a conversation about national reconciliation and the future of Cuba. And that, at that time, was not a very popular position here in Miami.
I was going to say, did you lose a lot of friends? I mean, that must have annoyed a lot of people.
It did annoy a lot of people, and I lost friends that probably I didn't want to have anyway. But at the end of the day, the position which I took is becoming a popular position now here in the United States. You still have the hardliners here and in Cuba also. I've never seen anything more similar than hardliners in Cuba and the hardliners here in Miami. Mm. They want the status quo to remain. And I think the changes in Cuba will come about when the new generation comes to power. The Central Committee in Cuba right now, more than 80% is under 55 years of age. Those people, they know Castro when Castro was up in the hills and the Sierra Maestra. And they have, I'm sure, their own project for the future of Cuba.
In 2001, you returned to Cuba and met with Castro and some of the men you had fought against at the Bay of Pigs. What was that like to meet Fidel? Did you still consider him a dictator at that point?
You know, Fidel is what he is. Nobody that is in power for 50 years is not a dictator. But the fact of the matter is that I don't view Fidel nor anybody who fought against me and they're in the Bay of Pigs as enemy. We all, at the end of the day, are all Cubans. And I think that any Cuban that would want to kill other Cubans, who want to bomb Cuba, who wants to see hunger and strife and death and killing, is not the right kind of Cuban. To me, what happened at 50 years ago at the Bay of Pigs was a moment in history. If it were today, I would not do it. I would not take any action that would put the life of any Cuban in jeopardy. They're not at fault. So basically, before those 3 days of that conference ended, there was not a single person in that room who was not friendly to each other. And there was a special moment during that meeting where I was explaining the position where I was, which is a little town called San Blas, to Fidel Castro on a big board, and I was explaining what happened there. And we have been bombarded all night long for 3 days by mortars and cannons. Mm-hmm. And Fidel Castro called the gentleman who was in charge of that bombardment, who is now a colonel or a general in Cuba, and he walked up to me and he stretched his hand and we shook hands. When that gentleman and I, who were fighting each other just across a little highway for 3 days, shook hands, everybody in that room stood up and started applauding.
That's really impressive. What do you think of President Obama's Cuba policy right now? Is it encouraging for you?
No, it is not. I think that President Obama, he has done what he said during his campaign that he would do, and that is that he would take away the restrictions to allow Cuban Americans to go up to Cuba as many times as they want to and visit their family. He's done that. But I think that the embargo policy should be lifted completely. It's about time that the Cuban government recognizes their failings, deal with the issues of Cuba, deal with the problem of the lack of civil and political rights, and deal with the problem that we need to resolve the economic problems of Cuba. And the embargo has only served as an excuse not to resolve that or as an excuse for those failures.
Cuban-born attorney Alfredo Duran fought at the Bay of Pigs 50 years ago this week. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll leave it there today. We're clearly on a history roll at the big show, or I wouldn't have all these segments to offer up to you. Let me know what you learned, what you'd change, what questions you still have. You can reach me in all the usual ways at the How We Got Here webpage at theworld.org/history or at the How We Got Here Facebook group page. You can also email directly to howwegothere@gmail.com. And you can find me on Twitter. The handle is @JebSharp. Thanks for listening. I'll speak to you soon.